Proportionately speaking, we lock up an awful lot of people in this country. We have one of the highest prison populations in the world. Is that a bad thing, or is that perhaps just the natural and perhaps even desirable side effect of get tough policies, which arguably have contributed to the historically low levels of crime we've seen over the last couple of decades? Well, John Pfaff, a professor at Fordham University's law school, seems to think that maybe it's not such a good idea, that incarceration has many costs, many of them monetary, but many of them societal, that suggests that maybe we got a problem and maybe we need to do something about it. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's all about Locked In, the true causes of mass incarceration and how to achieve real reform.
Stay tuned for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. And it's starting now.
Lock them up. Isn't that what we should do with criminals? I mean, they're bad guys, right? We don't want bad guys on the street, so let's catch them and give them a fair trial. And if they're guilty, let's just put them in prison. And the longer, the better, especially if they're violent. Well, that certainly is a popular perception, a popular opinion in this country. It is so popular that we have one of the highest prison populations, perhaps the highest prison population in the entire planet. Certainly, proportionately speaking, we lock lots and lots of people up. And we've built lots and lots of prisons, and we pay lots and lots of money to do it. So there are a lot of costs associated with this policy, and indeed, there are lots of costs that don't necessarily get measured in monetary terms. John Pfaff, who's a professor at Fordham University's law school, is very concerned about those costs. He thinks that we've got a very serious issue here in this country. But fortunately, he's got some very interesting ideas about how to fix it.
My name is John Pfaff, and I'm a law professor at Fordham Law School in New York. And I've spent probably the past 12 years wrestling with one single question, namely, how do we end up with so many people in prison in the United States?
Well, it's because they've done bad things, right?
In theory, yes. But the extent to which we rely on incarceration, both compared to other countries as well as compared to ourselves, is hard to remotely begin to justify.
I see. So we're no worse than people in other countries who have far fewer people in prison then.
Correct. And in fact, our crime rates today are about where they were in 1970, but we have five times the incarceration rate. So unless we're somehow five times more criminogenic today than we were in the 70s, that's hard to justify. And if anything, I think we're probably less inclined to commit crimes now than we were back then. So it's even harder to justify the extent to which we rely on it right now.
Wait a minute. I thought that we were living in a dystopia and it's all carnage out there and the crime rates are sky high. You're telling me that that's not the case?
The carnage metaphor is an unfortunate one we've been forced to wrestle with for the past several weeks. But even despite the upticks in several cities, we still remain substantially safer than we have been in the past. And even if what we are seeing is a new, genuine rise in crime, that doesn't actually mean that incarceration is the proper response to that.
I see. Just to be clear, I don't study this area personally, but everything I've been reading over the last few years suggests that crime statistics in general, and certainly including violent crime, have over the last few years, last decade or two, have reached historic lows. As you say, there's been a bit of an uptick lately, and especially in a couple of big cities and specifically in the murder rate. But by and large, we're living in a much safer society now than we were 20, 25 years ago, right?
That's absolutely right. That if you look at sort of our official crime statistics, the uniform crime reports that track crimes reported to the police or arrests made by the police, we're about as safe as where we were in 1970. Crime sort of rose from 60 to 1991 and sort of been engaged in a slow, steady decline since 1991. We're back to where we were in the 1970s. And even the current rise has not undone much of that nationwide. If you look at other measures of crime, in particular the National Crime Victimization Survey, that instead of relying on reports to police, actually conducts a national wide interview on who has been victimized to find out people's personal history, regardless of whether or not they called the cops. Based on those numbers, we're the safest we've been by a substantial degree since even the 60s or the 50s.
Yeah, and again, anecdotally, again, I've not studied this. I'm reading these things second and third hand in newspapers and what I hope are reliable sources. But just anecdotally, I recall that when I was a college student in the late 70s, early 80s, that New York City was still very much considered, where you are, was considered such a dangerous place that a lot of suburban Midwestern boys like me were reluctant to go into the big city. You know, we thought it was, you know, taking your life into your hands. And you contrast that now with the great sense of safety that people have in your town. People walk everywhere. People are out and about doing things in most parts of the city.
Absolutely. And at a national level, you know, murder rates remain well below where they were even in the mid to late 2000s when we were celebrating how low murder rates were. And then it continued to drop into the mid 2010s and gone up a bit since then. But overall, they still remain fairly low.
Okay, well, I'm gonna play devil's advocate now. And this is an interesting thing, and it's not a question I've seen posed recently. Is there a causal relationship? On the one hand, we've got much higher incarceration rates now than we had in the 70s. And on the other hand, we've got much lower crime. If I wanted to make an argument, I could say, well, that's why the crime's gone down. It's because we put all the bad guys in jail.
It's a common argument, and it's not without some merit, but it's tricky. Just as an economist, from a statistical point of view, it's actually a very difficult relationship to examine, because on the one hand, when you send more people to prison, crime probably does go down. But as you have more crime, you send more people to prison, and disentangling that causal story is a very knotty issue. And there's a lot of very subpar work out there addressing it that tells it very complicated, and it complicates our efforts to really figure out what's going on. But I think what the best studies show is that, well, they show two important things. The first is that rising prison probably did matter during the 70s and the 80s in helping to either keep crime from growing more quickly or even to help start pushing it down in the early 90s. So when prison populations were, so maybe it helps to take a step back and talk about trends in incarceration.
Please.
From about 1925 to around 1975, the United States incarceration rate was kind of flat and boring. I would not have had the job I have in 1970s doing the work I do because no one cared. And there wasn't really much to study about incarceration. In fact, it was so stable and flat that in probably one of the worst timed articles ever written in academia, one of the great criminologists of his time, this guy Alfred Bloomstein, wrote an article saying the U.S. incarceration rate will never rise above about 100,000, where it had been for about 50 years. Because if it ever got higher than that, we changed the laws to push it back down because that's just about what the system's willing to handle.
So 100 people per 100,000.
That's about where it was from 1925 to the mid-1970s. Okay. And then it starts going up. And in 1979, it was a little above that when that paper came out, but not shockingly so. But it didn't stop. It just rose and rose and rose. And by around 2000, it sort of that it sort of pauses. By that point, it was already up to around 500 or 600 per 100,000.
Wow, that's a 500% increase, right?
It was a substantial, staggering increase in incarceration. And by 2010, when it peaked, the incarceration rate itself was around, the people in prison were around 550 or so, 600,000. Overall, if you include prisons and jails, is probably around 800 per 100,000 in prison. For comparison purposes, the German incarceration rate's around 80. Perhaps the most punitive Western European country is England. They're around 200, and we are at around 750 to 800. Nice. So it was a profound rise in incarceration.
Okay, what accounts for that? Was it a reaction to the perception, at least, that in the 70s crime was out of control?
I think that's a big part of the story, that during the 60s and 70s, as crime starts to rise, prison populations don't. In fact, in some parts of time, crime went up and the total number of people in prison went down. And that created, I think, a very strong political backlash that manifested itself in very punitive policies that very much favored being tough on crime. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we don't really have that good of an understanding of what really drove this process, because what makes it very hard, and I think what gets lost in a lot of the discussion, is that there's no real criminal justice system in the United States, even though we use that term a lot. It's a very disaggregated, conflicted group of systems that oftentimes don't really work well together, right? So you have the police who make the arrest, and they operate at the city level, and they respond to a commissioner who is appointed by a city-elected mayor. You have the prosecutor who's actually elected at the county level, and therefore responds to a county constituency that's not the same as a city. He's much more responsive to the suburbs that tend to be wealthier and whiter and safer, even though he's enforcing crime in more urban, poor, more minority areas, which is an underappreciated, I think, very major schism. Mm-hmm. You have sentence lengths that are set by state legislators. You have parole boards that are appointed by state-elected governors. Right? So there's not a single coherent system here that's trying to do something. When people say, well, the system does what it's designed to do, I think that's a conceptual error, that it's not designed. It can have predictable and very negative outcomes, but it's not really a designed system. It's kind of a haphazard, slapdash system of actors who interact in sometimes very not say hostile ways, but they're all pursuing their own separate agendas.
Yeah, we'll inject a little bit of constitutional law here. The Constitution leaves a lot of things to the states. Certainly the national government is supreme, but its sphere is limited. And one area where this is most apparent, if you look at the numbers, is law enforcement. I mean, certainly there are national law enforcement agencies, notably the FBI or the DEA. Correct me if I'm wrong, if you took all those federal officers and you put them in a pot, they wouldn't be nearly as many as the thousands, hundreds of thousands of police officers and sheriffs and other law enforcement people who are hired by either a state or, as you say, a local entity within the state.
There are fewer sworn FBI field agents than officers in the NYPD alone.
Wow. I'd never thought about that specifically, but yeah.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with John Pfaff, a professor at Fordham University Law School. And we're talking all about mass incarceration in this country, whether it's a problem, and if so, what we can do to fix it. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with John Pfaff. Stick around. Now it's time for our constitutional quiz recorded live at the We the People State Finals held this year at the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia, where there's also something called the Center for Politics. And the center has sent over Meg Hubeck to help with this week's constitutional quiz. We're also assisted by David Cash Earhart, the Director of Student Programs at the Sorensen Institute.
Well, Cash Earhart, our own Oprah Winfrey is walking around the audience with his portable microphone in hand, and he has picked a young man who, at least from this perspective, looks almost as tall as he is. Two tall men standing
Maybe
there.
Maybe taller.
My goodness gracious. This is the tall man's convention. Okay, and who is this tall young man you've got?
This individual's name is Philip.
Hello, I'm from Loudoun Valley.
Phil Thanks. Or Bill?
Phil.
Philip.
Philip from Loudoun County. Okay.
All right, Phil. This question is so easy that I can't believe I wrote it.
Thank you.
I would never give a question so, this easy to my students.
So if you get it wrong, you're really going to look bad.
No.
Okay, so I hope you're up to it. Which of the following terms best describes the type of government created by the Constitution? A democracy. B, a republic. C, a direct democracy, or D, an oligarchy.
While Phil is polling his classmates, what are those choices again, Meg?
A, a democracy. B, a republic. C, a direct democracy, or D, an oligarchy.
My class believes it is B, republic.
Your answer is B, a republic?
Ding, 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 ding.
Good job. Good job.
I'm embarrassed I wrote that.
That's right. Actually a very important point.
I actually actually get yelled at about this a lot.
And while Cash is finding us another contestant, let's review that.
Actually, in my job, a lot of people will yell at me, not yell at me, but send me nasty emails that say, we don't have a democracy, we have a republic. And so it is a true point of fact that although we call our government a democracy, it is in fact a republic.
Actually, yeah, and this came up repeatedly today in the section that I was judging, which was on voting rights. Because, of course, these days in the United States, after many expansions of the franchise, first to African-American men in the 15th Amendment, and then to all women in the 19th Amendment, to 18-year-olds, et cetera, many, many different expansions of the franchise, we've become a much more democratic nation than we were at the outset. But sometimes it's good to remind ourselves that democracy was not a positive thing to our founders, that they were very much elitists. They considered themselves part of a natural aristocracy. And today we explored that idea a little bit in at least the sections that my fellow judges and I were doing, because there are some lingering questions about how democratic we want to be. Is it always a good thing to be a democracy, or are there some inherent weaknesses in democracy?
That's a really good discussion. And it was in Unit 4, and we also had the same question about the founders not wanting everyone necessarily to participate directly, which is why they created the Electoral College and why they had the systems of checks and balances and the bicameral House.
Right. And it illustrates one very important aspect of all of constitutional interpretation. Certainly, we respect the founders, but we've got to be careful not to revere them. Things aren't right simply because the founders felt that they were. We've made many, many changes, and our country has changed many times over the last 200 years. So while it's always relevant to ask what the founders' intentions were, it's not necessarily the only question that we ask.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today, my guest is John Pfaff, a professor of law at Fordham University's Law School. John writes and thinks a lot about mass incarceration in this country. He thinks it's quite a problem. And among the problems, even though it's national in scope, among the problems in measuring it is that our criminal justice system is very localized. And so it's very difficult even to get your arms around all the statistics that supposedly will tell us where the problems are.
So we do have criminal statutes on the national level, and they are enforced by national police forces. But because most policing is left to the states, we end up with this somewhat disjointed system that you describe. And so I think the initial problem is just trying to get your hands on all the statistics. People in your field, where do you begin?
It's daunting. It's daunting because it's not just state, you have to go county and local, right? So one of my favorite examples of this is, we sort of tend to talk about criminal justice outcomes at the state level. You know, California's doing this and New York is doing that. But even that's not exactly right. So one of the longest sustained decarcerations in the United States right now is New York State. While a lot of states started shrinking their prison populations in around 2009, 2010, New York was one of the few states that actually started in 1999. And we've dropped about 25,000 prisoners since 1999, from about 75,000 to from around 880,000 to around 55,000. But what's interesting is that New York State didn't actually decarcerate. New York City did. The five boroughs of New York sent fewer and fewer people to prison, even as the rest of the state was sending more people to prison. So this giant New York State decline is actually a story of New York City changing its policies, even as the rest of the state stayed harsh. Mm-hmm. And so you're right that, you know, simply having state data isn't enough. You need to have county data, and that's even harder to get. And I think what makes it particularly hard is that what my work has shown is that the most important person in this whole story, at least today and since the 1990s, has been the prosecutor, the county level elected prosecutor. And we have almost no data on them whatsoever. Unlike policing and unlike prisons, they don't provide any centralized data to the federal government that they can aggregate up into like our uniform crime reports or our national prisoner stats. They're just complete and total empirical black boxes.
Oh my, and that really is important, and it's an important gap in your knowledge, in our knowledge. And one that I've actually experienced personally. I grew up just north of Detroit, and that metropolitan area is among the most segregated in the country.
And certainly the county I grew up in, Oakland County, was just as you describe. It was some very wealthy suburbs with mostly white people in them, and then some relatively poor areas, especially centered around the central city of Pontiac, Michigan. And we had a local prosecutor for many years, a county executive, I believe. His name was, Brooks Patterson. But I recall the rhetoric. It was always get tough on crime. And what it really amounted to was a bunch of people who look like me voting people into office to go and get tough on those black people in Pontiac. And so when you've got diffuse political control, when you've got sort of, in a sense, at-large voting through the county, and you've got majority white suburbs with certain, quote-unquote, problem areas that are predominantly minority, that then sets up a circumstance where the majority can, rightly or wrongly, direct all the resources into that one community and adopt some fairly aggressive policing in that community.
And it also means they might not focus on the crimes that matter the most, right? Mm-hmm. So we oftentimes talk about the problem of over-policing in a lot of urban communities, but it's less a problem of over-policing and more a problem of mispolicing. So an example from Los Angeles, although I'm sure the numbers are similar in other cities, the clearance rate for murder in Los Angeles, the rate at which a murder results in an arrest, overall it's about 60%. Which might sound surprisingly low, that about one-third of all murders don't result in arrest, but that's about the national average nationwide at this point. Mm-hmm. For black men, the clearance rate is 30%. So two-thirds of all people who kill a black man do not get arrested. Hmm. Yet at the same time, the LAPD has a fairly big, you know, drug unit and other units, right? And so they're under-enforcing murder because the murder doesn't necessarily scare the wealthier, whiter suburbs. The murder is not going to come to them. But the drugs might, right? And so that encourages police and prosecutors to target these offenses that scare the politically powerful, even those that aren't necessarily the crimes that are actually causing the most harm in the areas where crime is concentrated.
Yeah. I think there is a certain self-interest, or at least perception of self-interest, and a certain callousness. If you're controlling the county government and you're living in the relatively affluent and safe suburb, it's possible just to think of the problem areas as infections to be contained rather than communities to be helped.
I think that's right. And that problem is magnified when we start paying closer attention to the way in which race manifests itself in our decisions. And there's many different ways in which this happens, all of which are underappreciated and incredibly distressing to think about. So one is there's evidence that ever since the end of slavery, at a sort of a sociological level, we've come to view offending by white people as a form of individual pathology. This person did something wrong, and this person needs to be addressed. But offending by African Americans is viewed as a broader cultural failure, that they as a community have failed. That's where sort of that the politics of respectability emerges from that view, that any one criminal failing by an African American is attributed to the group as a whole, but we don't do the same thing for white people. We see this manifest itself also in the terrorism context, right? When one Muslim commits an act of terrorism, we expect the Muslim community as a whole to repudiate that, but no one demanded that white people apologize for Dylan Root, right? He was a unique one-off in a way that we don't view that for other groups. So that leads us to overreact to the enforcement of minority communities because we view it as a much broader sort of collective failure that we don't see it when it happens with a white person.
Yeah, indeed. There's a heck of a lot of racial baggage that goes with this. I've heard some people describe these rather high incarceration rates as, in some sense, the modern Jim Crow, that this is a way to keep especially young black men off the streets.
Yes. I sometimes wrestle with that metaphor, not because I disagree with what the collective impact, the racially disparate impact of mass incarceration has done. I think it's right that it has had an incredibly strong and powerful racial bias to it that has had some rather shocking community-wide impacts. My concern with that is that the old Jim Crow laws were centralized edicts designed to impose racial harm, right? They said whites can be here, blacks must be over there, and mm-hmm. It's explicitly built into the code, which suggests that you could come along and then repeal that code, right? You could fix this at the top down, right? Change the law, and the new Jim Crow restrictions, to some extent, go away, although the social pressures would remain. Mm-hmm. with the current system, while it's having Jim Crow-like segregatory disparate impact effects, I think it's much more bottom up, right? That's not a centralized ruling. It's racially biased decisions by the police, and then similarly biased, but independently racially biased decisions by prosecutors, by parole boards, right? And collectively, they all add up to an incredibly profoundly disparate blow to African American communities. But it's harder, I think, to fix because, as Michelle Alexander has pointed out, it's couched in this race neutral language. But I think also because it is much more of a diffuse means by which it's operating. I fear sometimes that the new Jim Crow metaphor almost gives us hope that we can sort of, there's some sort of big top down fix to this, and there's not. In fact, I find it very telling that Michelle Alexander, who wrote the new Jim Crow book, she's actually resigned her position as a law professor and is now at Union Theological Seminary in New York, basically out of the belief that the law can never get us out of this, that what we need is some sort of profound spiritual, cultural change, and that you have to approach it as much more of a theological crisis than a legal one.
Well, that's a very interesting idea, and it's actually what I was just thinking of myself as you were describing this. This is a... it's a diffuse problem. It's a problem that involves many different actors in many different communities. And to the extent that there's a commonality here, then maybe it's a symptom of societal attitudes that are very difficult to change and maybe even go so far as to be spiritual in nature.
They're spiritual, and they also can be, in an almost shocking kind of way, physical. But by which I mean, I heard a psychologist give a talk recently about serves the challenges we face with racial bias. And one of the results he talked about, which I hadn't heard before, and it's quite shocking, is that when we talk to someone, so he was talking about some sort of cutting edge neurological studies on racial bias. And when we talk to another person, there's a part of our brain that tends to be more active, that's sort of the social interaction part of our brain that says, this is another person, I'm interacting at a social level with this person. There's a different part of our brain that is more active when we're dealing with some sort of object. And there's been some studies that have shown that like some white people, when they talk to a black person, the social part is much less active than it should be, and the object part is much more active.
Oh, right? My.
That at a fundamental, almost neurological level that they themselves might be completely unaware of, they're viewing that black person as less than a person.
Yeah, I've read of studies that have made similar claims that in some sense racism is hardwired in us, that if you go back far enough in the evolutionary tree, that maybe this was a survival advantage to be suspicious of anyone who wasn't from one's own tribe.
Right.
Yeah, and that's
wary of those broad evolutionary arguments only because what we define as that key variable of distinction has shifted over time. I'm not sure we've always used skin color as this is the person we view as not us, but it certainly suggests that social values of viewing a certain group as being different can certainly seem to get hardwired at a more fundamental physical kind of level. And that then combines with sort of Americans have historically been much more punitive than other Western countries. It's from almost a colonial times. We've just taken a much more punitive attitude.
Okay, well, John, you've completely discouraged me. I'm a complete pessimist now. This is a diffuse problem. It's fundamental in society. It's spiritual in nature, perhaps even biological and evolutionary. So let's just throw up our hands and go home, right?
I guess, when confronted with an impossible problem, I like to dig in and figure out how to actually fix it.
Uh-huh.
So I for one, am not necessarily discouraged by it. But at the same time, I do think it is important for us to understand just how the magnitude of this, that the fix is not going to be easy. And sometimes I get concerned with some of the reform efforts we see today that they're suggesting we can accomplish a lot in a fairly low cost kind of way. And I think that's not true, that the challenge we face here is very, very deep. It's not insurmountable. And I think there are ways that, while I'm certainly sympathetic to Michelle Alexander's position that this is far more than a legal crisis, and I think she's absolutely right. I still think there is a lot the law can do to minimize those costs, to push people away from acting ways that impose those costs. I haven't yet despaired, but it is a deep challenge. And as much as mass incarceration itself is a fairly new phenomenon, right? Didn't really start until the 70s. The underlying causes of it are deeply rooted and go back much further than the 70s.
Okay. So even with all of the unknowns and with all of the difficulty in collecting data, one statistic does stick out, and that is that we in this country, for some reason, incarcerate people at 5 times the rate that we did just a few decades ago, and at many times the rate that people in what I might call comparable nations, that is sort of Western-style liberal democracies with some sort of market economy, at much, much higher rates than those countries do. So if nothing else, that is a notable fact, one that certainly carries a lot of racial baggage, certainly carries a lot of socioeconomic baggage. It certainly is very expensive to do that as well from a purely economic point of view. And that brings me to my next observation is that you keep talking about costs. You sound like one of those pointy-headed economists.
So when I talk about the cost of incarceration, in many ways, I'm not talking about the financial costs.
But before we go on, though, this is your shtick, isn't it? This is your focus, is that you look at things from an economic perspective, right?
I look at them from an empirical perspective. Uh-huh. I'm not committed necessarily to sort of the budgetary economics approach, because I think that actually misses where the real costs of incarceration are. Mm-hmm. Right? So oftentimes people try to justify decarceration on the grounds that, you know, each prisoner we free will save $30,000 in state costs. Now, that's actually not true. That overstates what we save per prisoner, because about half of all correctional spending goes to wages. So unless you lay off guards or allow them to retire and don't fill their spots, you actually don't save nearly that much for each prisoner you release. The marginal cost per inmate is actually substantially lower. But even putting that aside, I think focusing on the, you know, $50 billion a year we spend on prisons, the $80 billion a year we spend on prison and jails, that's a decent amount of money. But, you know, state and local governments spend about $2 trillion a year on everything. $80 billion is not a big chunk of that, even though it's a big chunk of money. The real costs of incarceration that get far too little attention are the huge social costs that come from locking someone up, right? So, you know, there's the fact that that person's away from his family. The child now grows up without one parent or perhaps without two parents. That increases the risk of that child going to prison. Prison is a vector of tuberculosis, of other diseases, of HIV and other STDs. The risk of dying from a drug overdose rises precipitously upon release from prison, because while in prison, drug habits aren't cured, but drugs are more expensive and lower quality. When you come out of prison, drugs are cheaper and better quality. And if you don't understand that your tolerance has shifted, it's very easy to die from a drug overdose. Mm. In some neighborhoods, we've locked up so many young men that it actually throws off the dating market, right? That a functioning marriage dating market requires about one man to one woman. And in some high incarceration neighborhoods, it's like 60-40, 60 women to every 40 men. And that absolutely skews marriage and dating. There's studies that show that in the short to middle term, every year in prison takes 2 years off your life. And these are, and not to mention the fact that it cuts down on income, it cuts down on future earnings, it increases the risk of going onto welfare, it increases the risk of homelessness, it increases the risk of all sorts of other sort of social costs, right? We've never been able to get a good estimate of what these costs are, but I'm sure they dwarf the $80 billion a year we spend on prison.
Yeah, I've encountered this a couple of times. We've devoted several episodes to efforts to legalize marijuana, and we've spoken to people who are working in that direction, and they make the point that, you know, when you arrest a young man from a minority community for some low-level drug offense, you've basically made him unemployable. And that you've pushed him on a track that he might not be able to get off of. I've also spoken to people, some of my friends and colleagues at the University of Tennessee, who study discipline within schools. And they've noted that there's a pipeline that when students are punitively treated in school, when they're suspended, when they're expelled, that this leads directly, they call it a school prison pipeline. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess what I'm hearing from you is that you're just not a big fan of incarceration itself because it imposes lots of other costs. I mean, surely you would agree that some people need to be incarcerated, right?
Absolutely. I'm not. There are some who call themselves prison abolitionists who believe we should basically get rid of the prison almost altogether. I'm not an abolitionist, but we dramatically overuse it. And so, I mean, some good examples of that is that, you know, sending someone to prison doesn't actually necessarily deter the crime from happening. That deterrence operates almost entirely on the policing side, the risk of getting caught. Being sent to prison doesn't necessarily deter the person at all. That sentence is off in the future. People tend to engage in antisocial behavior, tend to be young, and therefore not necessarily thinking about the future too much, as young people don't. And just in general, tend to be very present-minded. So some long sentence months down the line, that doesn't really figure into their decision today to engage in antisocial criminal behavior. But the cop on the corner, the risk of getting caught now, that does. From an incapacitation point of view, we tend to run our long sentences, at least the threat of them, substantially over incarcerates people. That you know, we tend to use this term a lot. I never used it before, I tried to never use it now, this term like violent offender. And mm-hmm. The reason why I don't use the term violent offender, instead I use someone convicted of a crime of violence, is because to call someone a violent offender is to say that is who this person is. This person is violent. It is a status, as opposed to a phase, right? People age into and age out of violence. An 18-year-old is more violent than a 10-year-old. An 18-year-old is more violent than a 40-year-old. Some of it is hormonal. It's tied to testosterone levels. Some of it is social. When you have a job or a marriage, that makes it harder to engage in crime because you're doing other things and your sense of who you are shifts. Some of it is just physical, right? If you're 40, you're less likely to get in a fight than when you're 20, simply because you know you're going to lose, right?
I'm 41 now. Excuse me, but
you're so right in that regard, John. You're so right in that regard.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I'm speaking with John Pfaff of Fordham University Law School. We're talking about mass incarceration and criminality. And as John just pointed out, most guys over 40 are not getting into fights. And I must admit, it's been quite a while since I've kicked anybody's butt. Listening to your weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with John Pfaff, the author of a new book, Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. John and I were just talking about how a lot of the problem is embedded in our language. We'll refer to people who in their youth do bad things as ex-offenders or violent ex-offenders. These are labels that cause problems for the rest of these people's lives.
But you've also picked up on something. I think that your unwillingness to use that term really goes to one of the very important aspects of this, is that once you go to prison, especially if it is because you've been convicted of a violent offense, that's your identity for the rest of your life.
Exactly. You're a violent offender and an ex-con. And
yeah.
When you think about it, conviction is one of the only things where the ex attaches to you for the rest of your life, right? I'm an ex-teenager, but no one calls me that. I'm an ex-college student because I've graduated from college, but no one calls me that, right? But if you go to prison, you're an ex-con forever. And oftentimes, not just socially, but legally. We impose all these restrictions on people when they're released from prison that are designed in theory to keep us safe, but often collectively end up making things worse by making it almost impossible for the person released from prison to get their lives back on track.
Okay, so we imprison people at a rate much greater than the rest of the world, at least the Western world. Those costs are not just the nominal costs, but societal costs, which we've just discussed to some extent. What are the solutions? You've just written a whole book. What are the solutions to this? And I'm using the plural here because I know that there's not a one size fits all thing.
Right. There's lots of things to target, and you know, I think in the short run is focusing on the politics of it and the legal structures. In the long run, it is, I think, focusing more on some of the more cultural issues. I think one thing we definitely need to do and have not been doing this yet is to focus on what prosecutors do and why they do it. What my research has shown is that at least since crime started dropping in the 1990s, almost the entire growth in prison that took place since then has come from prosecutors being more aggressive. That we have fewer and fewer crimes being committed. We're arresting fewer and fewer people. So there's fewer and fewer people entering the criminal justice system. But there are more and more people being charged with felonies, which are the offenses that carry with them the risk of going to prison. And so prosecutors are charging more people, even though they have fewer and fewer people to charge.
Why? Why are they doing that?
That is the $80 billion question, right? That.
Well said. May I offer a possible explanation? Well, I'll note the contrast between public defenders who are rarely, if to my knowledge, ever elected, and prosecutors who are. And I've taught students who have gone on to be prosecutors, and they've friended me on Facebook, and I've watched their campaigns, and what gets them elected and reelected. They talk about how tough they're going to be.
That has long been the story. So I'll first add that you're right about public defenders, except for Florida, where they do elect their public defenders in the same election cycle as their prosecutors, in the same district as their prosecutors.
You know what? I should have known that since I'm a member of the Florida Bar and I practiced down there all throughout the 1990s. But that's instructive as well, because people paid a lot of attention to prosecutors' races, not so much to public defender races, not so much. Because they were not seen as future judges and future politicians. You know, public defenders just, if people pay attention to them at all, it's in a disparaging way. Oh, those are the guys who represent the criminals. But prosecutors, they're good side. They're representing us. They're protecting us. And by golly, I want them to be tough.
Yep. And here's where a little ray of optimism starts to creep into my conversation. So you're right that historically speaking, prosecutors have always run on being tough on crime. Yet in 2016, the election cycle in which, you know, millions of people voted for Donald Trump, which Donald Trump ran on a very old school 1980s tough on crime, carnage everywhere kind of campaign, during that same election cycle, about 20 anti-tough on crime prosecutors won elections, upsetting the incumbents.
Really? Where?
Chicago, when Kim Fox ousted Anita Alvarez. We saw it in Dallas, where Kim Ogg won in 2015. I like this example because it's not a city. Scott Colum beat this guy named Allgood, who had been this like 20, 25-year prosecutor in a rural district in Mississippi. And a black Democrat upset a white incumbent on the grounds that he was going to be smarter on crime and less needlessly punitive. In St. Louis, the outgoing DA's handpicked successor, who is a much more tough on crime person, lost in the primary to a reformer who then went on to win the general election. Corpus Christi actually elected a former defense attorney as their new prosecutor. Brooklyn elected a reformer in 2013. Right, so you're starting to see this wave of change where in a lot of urban places, reform-minded candidates are winning. And in fact, in Philadelphia, Seth Williams just declined to run for re-election in, I believe, 2017 or 2018. In part because of criticism that he was too tough on crime. And so you're starting to see people realize that these prosecutors are important, and that prosecutors who run on pledges to be smarter and less punitive and more cautious in how they use their power are able to mount successful campaigns for the position.
I wonder if those are districts where we don't have that representation problem we described earlier, where, in other words, these are communities voting for their own prosecutors rather than a largely white county voting for a local prosecutor or a prosecutor who's going to be tough on those minorities in that minority community. So you mentioned Brooklyn, you mentioned a couple of other places, Chicago. Is this a matter of the minority people or the people from the high crime communities who are demanding change in their own communities? Is that what's happening?
I think that helps. You know, St. Louis is one of those cities that doesn't have a ring county. St. Louis City is its own district. Mm-hmm. Brooklyn's its own district. But no, even take Chicago, right? You know, Chicago, about half of Cook County does not live in the city of Chicago. Half of Cook County is in the ring cities around Chicago.
And yet they still voted the other person in.
But there's good and bad in Chicago, right? So the city voted for Kim Fox and the suburbs voted for Kim Fox. But one thing Cook County does, they actually break their votes out by city versus non-city votes. Mm-hmm. And where Kim Fox won, I believe, 70-30 in the city, she won 60-40 in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a 10-point, her margin shrunk by 10 points. Mm-hmm. So the suburbs came along, but, you know, a little bit less so. You know, Dallas elected a reformer, and Dallas has a large ring, and I think has a substantial suburban component to its county. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think you are seeing the reforms push ahead hard. These kind of victories are more likely in communities that have larger minority populations. But they're still happening in cities that have substantial ring suburbs around them.
Okay, so maybe hearts and minds are changing in some areas in the country, and maybe there's going to be less pressure on these prosecutors to be tough on crime and maybe more to be smart on crime. What else? What else is going to help us with our disproportionate incarceration rate?
I mean, I think one of the trickier issues, and we've been very, very slow moving in this direction, but I'm starting to feel the conversation shift, is at some point we have to start having very honest conversations about violent crime. The narrative we've been told is that we are where we are because we are locking up all these low-level nonviolent drug offenders for very long periods of time. And that's wrong on two fronts. One is that we actually aren't locking up that many people in prison for drug offenses. Only about 16% of all people in state prisons are there on a drug charge. And most sentences are for fairly short periods of time. Where growth has really happened is from locking up people convicted of violence. Over half of all state prisoners are in prison for a violent crime.
Well, I see, and the people listening are going to say, well, that's a good thing, though. So what's the problem there?
Exactly. So several problems with that. To be fair, to start, some people convicted of serious violent crimes do need to be in prison, whether it's from a self-protection, from a protective point of view, or even perhaps from a moral legitimacy of the law point of view. I get that. But here are the problems. First, when I use the word violent crime, I'm sure everyone's sort of stereotyped mental image is something like threatening to shoot someone with a gun during a bank, during a robbery. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of crimes that are classified as violent where no one's actually hurt, or maybe no one even could be hurt. So in New York State, for example, it's classified as a violent crime to break into someone's home, even if they're not home, and even if the person breaking in is unarmed. Still classified as a violent crime.
So if I'm an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old in New York State, and some afternoon after school I go and bust down someone's door and steal a television set, I've committed a violent crime.
In New York State, and I believe other states like Mississippi, correct.
Okay, so maybe it's the definition of violent crime that you're aiming at then.
That's part of it, right? That there are some violent crimes, even ones that have fairly serious terms like robbery, where perhaps even armed robbery, which might not necessarily involve like a gun. It could involve just like even like a stick or a rock, right? Where I heard about one case of a student who, I think in a food fight, you know, threw something at school and threw something at his friend, but the friend ducked and hit the teacher, and the you know, what we call the school resource officer, which is the actual police officer in the school, arrested him for like assault or perhaps even aggravated assault because he hit the teacher on her jacket with like a donut, right? But I don't want to downplay the fact that many of the violent crimes that land people, particularly in prison, they have caused actual harm. But even then, if our goal is to really reduce crime, violent crime, prison is not always the way to actually effectively accomplish that. There are better ways we could do this. So I mentioned earlier that studies have shown that prison did play, the rising prison populations did play a fairly sizable role in reining in crime growth during the 80s and helped bring it down in the early 90s, but that effect has since gotten much weaker. But the people who produced those studies at the same time will be the first to admit that other approaches would have worked better.
What are the other approaches that would work better in prison?
If nothing else, just better policing, right? To intervene before it happens. And there's a growing body of evidence that shows that there are really effective interventions we can use to reduce crime before it happens rather than responding afterwards. And like I said, the deterrent impact of prison is appears to be fairly negligible, right? So there's these ideas of what's called like focused deterrence, where you do a very rigorous study in a neighborhood to figure out who's involved, most involved in sort of committing acts of violence, oftentimes members of gangs, but not just indiscriminately, but who within which groups is most sort of in the center of violence. And you sit down with them and you explain to them that you're going to focus on them in particular very, very directly. At the same time, while you threaten them with sort of this focus of turns, you offer them a wide array of social support services if they opt to leave sort of the violent aspects of what they've been doing. And you bring in community members to try to talk to them. And there's, you know, a sizable body of evidence that shows that this is proven to be oftentimes a fairly effective strategy. Another one that's getting a lot of attention these days is this program called Cure Violence, which views shooting as an epidemic, right? That when A shoots B, that thing creates sort of a transmittable disease, that B is going to retaliate. And when B retaliates, he's going to shoot C. And C is going to retaliate and then in the process shoot D. And in fact, there's one study recently that showed that I believe in Chicago, they're able to link like 400 shootings back to sort of one initial shot. And everything else that came from that was like a disease spreading of retaliatory shots. And what Cure Violence tries to do is get members of that community who have social respect amongst the people involved and get them to interrupt that transmission, right? They view it as a disease. And if A shoots B, you then sit down with B and B's friends and B's family and try to figure out a way to prevent that shot from being transmitted to the next person.
Okay.
And it's not, and there's evidence showing that the uptick in Chicago shootings seems to be tied pretty tightly to slashing funding for Cure Violence in Chicago. So there are lots of sort of non-punitive interventions, not non-punitive, I'm sorry, non-incarcerating interventions that seem to work much better than prison. But there is one huge cost that we aren't really addressing in current reform efforts, which is that any of these police-based interventions are vulnerable to what we can call the Willie Horton effect, right? That
one person goes out and does poorly after such an intervention, then the public reacts very negatively.
Exactly. And that problem doesn't afflict prison, right? If you use a non-prison option, the mistake is going to be someone committing a crime you could have prevented from happening.
Right.
The mistake with prison is that someone gets locked up who doesn't need to be locked up.
Right.
But
and that's somewhat invisible, at least to the wider public, whereas Willie Horton, who's let out in a prison furlough and then murders somebody, well, that makes a great campaign commercial.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what no one knows is that furlough program had over a 99% success rate, right? Willie Horton was the incredibly rare exception to how that program worked. But no one knows that. Everyone knows the story of Willie Horton.
My. Well, John, this is fascinating, but we are running a little short on time. So we've discussed at least two ways you think we could reduce incarceration rates, and I'm sure we're leaving several of them on the table. But I'll give you time just to discuss a third. What's a third strategy before we go?
So I think related to the Willie Horton effect is we have to think much more carefully about the politics of punishment. How do we give elected DAs and judges and parole boards the room to be smart without worrying about that one bad case blowing up in their face? Right? How do we provide the system with a certain degree of insulation so it doesn't have to respond to the crime of the day, the crime of the week? And right now, that's not on the table at all, that reformers are passing laws through the very same system that didn't work last time, right? They're kind of, the conditions are right now to push reform bills through, so they are, but if conditions reverse, and that might be happening for all we know right now, the system is just as prone to overreact this time as it was before. And I think we need to think about how to provide a certain amount of political independence and insulation from these sort of day-to-day pressures.
Well, I don't know how to do it, John. Maybe you need to go off to a seminary and pray.
I mean, changing our attitude. I mean, I'll end with sort of showing how deep our punitiveness runs and why there really is a need to rethink this. There's a county in, I believe, Mississippi that just passed an ordinance that is going to send people to jail for not paying their library fines. And that's how deeply we think that if something goes wrong, jail or prison is the response. It is a deeply ingrained attitude that is going to take some time, I think, to dial back.
John? When I think back on my own history and of those of my two sons when they were little boys, I'd still be in prison for library fines.
I think I've dodged a bullet myself recently.
Understood. Well, John Pfaff of Fordham Law School, thank you very, very much for sharing these ideas with us. And what's the name of your book again?
It's Locked In, and it's out now.
It's out now. Locked In by John Pfaff. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to John Pfaff of Fordham University Law School. What an interesting fellow and what interesting ideas. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.